There's snow on the ground with a little more snow in the forecast for the weekend. But the weather forecast calls for a warm-up next week. It's only a matter of time before your lawn and garden are ready for another growing season. I'm Jim Meadows, and today we have another lawn and garden care edition of Focus. My guest, Sandy Mason of the University of Illinois Extension, is here to answer your questions about getting your yard ready for spring. What prep work should you be doing? What's in the seed catalogs this season? And for Valentine's Day, how about some tips on displaying cut flowers? Those garden questions and more answered on Focus. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and this is a lawn and garden edition of Focus. And we invite your calls and emails for our guest, horticulture expert Sandy Mason of the University of Illinois Extension. Sandy, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you.
And understand it's snowing outside.
Yes, it is. It's a perfect day to talk about gardening, right? When it's snowing outside.
Well, as you look ahead to the time when there will not be snow on the ground, call in with your questions at 1-800-222-9455. That's toll-free. 1-800-222-WYLL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. will-talk@illinois.edu. And someone already did, who are looking ahead to, I guess, will be the first season in Champaign when they can keep chickens in their backyards. And Angie and Martin Wright, we live in Champaign. We're gearing up for the arrival of our first season of spring chickens, but first we need to build our coop and run. And that means doing something with a thick growth of clematis, 5 years old or more. Is it possible to transplant these? Do we subdivide them like other perennials? And when is the best time to do that?
Well, I'm not sure. There's a number of different types of clematis or clematis, and I'm not sure which one they're talking about. If it's the white one that blooms kind of late season, kind of in August and September, that one you can't hardly kill. But you could certainly do it in the springtime. Usually when it starts to pop up in the spring, you can divide that one fairly easily and move it around. And that one's really, really tough. So that's kind of a sweet autumn clematis that blooms kind of late season. It has real fragrant small flowers. The other clematis or clematis with the great big flowers are a little bit harder to divide. You certainly can move them. I'd move them at the same time. About the time, you know, they start to show a little bit of growth in the springtime, then I would go ahead and move them. They're not as easy to divide. So I probably, if it's the big flowered one, I probably wouldn't divide it. I'd just go ahead and move it in the spring, and it should be fine.
Okay. So just go ahead and move it if it's that type.
Right.
Of clematis.
Right. Either one, you could go ahead and move it in the springtime, certainly when it starts to show a little bit of growth. The only one I would divide would really be probably the sweet autumn, the one that's that late blooming kind of little white one.
Well, there must be a lot of perennials underneath all that snow.
Yeah.
I know in the apartment building I live in, there are daffodils that come out every
year.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But, of course, we're wondering, it's gotten so cold for sustained periods. Does this affect any perennials at all?
You know, I think the one thing, you know, we may not be all that excited about the snow, certainly when it's, even though it's pretty, when it's on the roads, it's not that much fun. But the one thing is, snow actually is a very good insulator. So it's actually good for the perennials and our plants and the fact that we do have snow cover, because that pretty well keeps it right at that freezing, a little right around freezing, so it doesn't get like super, super cold. So for them, it actually works out really well. So it's one of those things that I don't think we're going to see a big problem with that. I think the question I sometimes get is that if plants feel wind chill or not. I hear that question from time to time, and just sort of let people know, no, plants do not feel wind chill. Wind chill is just for animals, us, that actually have inherent heat. Since plants don't have heat, they're not losing heat, and it's not a skin thing and all that kind of thing with plants. So plants don't, even though it's still pretty cold when it's like minus 10 or whatever it is, they're not feeling those really, really super cold temperatures that we might feel through wind chill.
So. Now, I guess we could be hopeful that maybe some insects might be affected by the cold weather. We were hoping to have Phil Nixon, entomologist with the Extension, on today. He's at an event out of town. It isn't available. But he left me some materials saying, You may have been hopeful that that the cold weather would kill all those insects, but with few exceptions, you're sort of out of luck. There have been some recent reports that the cold weather has affected the emerald ash borer, and that would, of course, be good news. The emerald ash borer has been sighted in Champaign County and other parts of downstate Illinois. However, research found that the emerald ash borer supercooled to 25 degrees below zero with little mortality above that temperature, from what I can tell, from what Phil can tell. The coldest it's been in Illinois has just been 20 below zero in the Chicago area. So not enough to kill the emerald ash borer.
Yeah, we're always hopeful, aren't we, on those really kind of destructive insects that are out there. So, I wish that was the case, but I'm afraid insects are just amazingly adaptable. So I think that is one of those things that, you know, maybe for us we're not going to see that. And the other concern that I think we have with emerald ash borer is that if it's cold enough to actually go ahead and kill them within the tree, because they're right underneath the bark, it's also going to damage the tree. If it's that cold, it may also be causing frost cracks and stuff within the tree. So we may see some problems with the trees overall, even if it got cold enough to do that. So I think that might be one of the one things. I think the one things that we might see some changes in, really what I'm thinking of are those insects that are really out there, as in they're in the air. Things like bagworms, I would think, because they're out there, as in they're not protected by snow. They're not protected by a lot of things. So we may see some issues with those guys. And it's sort of looking and see what Phil had some comments. He did say mimosa webworm and honey locust plant bug seem to be limited by cold weather, so we might see some issues with those. I think the other thing people had questions about grubs and Japanese beetle grubs and all those kinds of those guys. It looks like for long-term frozen soils, it may have reduced some populations, but most of the time they're not frozen long enough. So I think that goes back to that whole adaptability of insects, grubs in particular, but also just the fact that because of that insulating snow cover that we're having, maybe it's good for the plants, but it's also probably good for the grubs in that they aren't getting as cold as long either. So it's kind of, I think with all of this stuff, it's always kind of good news, bad news. The snow cover is good for the plants, but maybe it's protecting the grubs more. So I think there's a lot of issues here that sort of come in, and to realize, you know, insects are, you know, they're very adaptable, and there's reasons why they're all over the place. It's just the fact that they're amazingly adaptable.
They're just designed to stick around.
Absolutely. And so, you know, for a lot of the insects that we have, you know, they're native, clear up in, or they're not native, but they certainly can be found way north of here, into Wisconsin, maybe even into Canada. And so we would have to have below normal temperatures even for Wisconsin and Canada in order for some of these insects to die. So, you know, I know we're always looking for that good news thing when it comes to really cold temperatures, but I'm not sure we're necessarily going to find it right now.
Well, a lot of people might be used to looking at bare ground this time of February. Perhaps next week when the temperature goes up, there will be some bare ground to see. But I gather gardeners are starting to think about what they're going to do. And I'm just wondering, what are the things you think of that you need to think of as February returns to March?
Well, I think certainly one of the things that we saw an awful lot of damage last year on fruit trees, because a lot of the apples in particular produce a big crop. And if people weren't used to thinning them, they may have found they had some real damage on the tree. So this is really, as we get into March, this is really a time to be thinking about pruning your apple trees, fruit trees, and to clean them up, get rid of those broken branches. And really, you may find they have to remove quite a bit of branches in order to get rid of that damage that they had.
So that's important to do if you've had a heavy crop and you didn't trim.
Yeah, and it didn't, thin. Because when they put on, you know, some years they don't put on a huge apple crop, and so you don't have this horrible weight on them, and so we don't have to worry about it. Now, commercially, you know, they thin the crop. They actually remove some of the young apples. Well, in our home orchards, we don't think about that. We always think, you know, more is better. but the trees just can't tolerate all that weight. And so really they need to be thinned, and unfortunately a lot of people didn't thin them last year, and so they're going to find that there's an awful lot of damage on their fruit trees. So March is a great time to be doing that sort of cleanup in your orchard. Also, if you have even other trees that need to be pruned or maybe saw some damage, that's a time to really be thinking about pruning those.
Are there any other plants that need that sort of maintenance as you begin the season?
Yeah, certainly as we get into March, you may find that there's some plants that you do want to just some major overhauls on them. I always think of red twig dogwood. You know, we enjoy the red twigs during the winter time, but after they've been there for 5, 6, 7 or more years, they get kind of leggy. They often can get a scale insect. So sometimes they actually just need to be trimmed down to the ground. So there's some plants that we'd actually go ahead and just prune down to the ground. You might leave, 4 to 6 inches of growth. That's fine. It doesn't have to be flat with the ground, but actually to remove all that because they'll look so much better. You'll get better red twigs. They'll get rid of the insect issues. So that would be one. If you have privets, anything that doesn't bloom early, you could certainly go ahead and prune back, maybe even clear to the ground, depending on what it is. If it's an early bloomer like lilacs and forsythia, you wouldn't want to do that until after they flower because they already have their flower buds on right now. So if you do any trimming on those, you're going to remove the flower buds.
I wonder if there are any issues with all the snow that's being plowed and then piled up along, say, the side of the road, perhaps along some decorative plantings there.
Right.
If there are some things you have to, once you can get through that snow, to repair and sort of mend up.
Right. And absolutely, I actually have an issue. I had some boxwoods, and then I had so much sort of heavy snow and ice that just fell on them. Once it started to melt, it just fell on top of them and just really kind of broke them apart a little bit. I got off as much as I can, but there's still a lot that's sort of stuck there. So I think people, as things thaw, they may find that even things like their arborvitae or maybe junipers or some of those even yews, maybe actually some damage there. So it would be one of those things where you may have to do a little cleanup because there's been damage just from either plowing and everything got piled up on top of them or maybe it slid off the roof or whatever. So I think as time goes on, we're going to find that there's some damage there. If it just sort of opened up, like the plant just sort of opened up, but it doesn't appear to be damaged, as in broken, you may find that you can either just gently sort of pull it back together or something. Sometimes you can sort of repair that without having to do some major pruning. But if it's obviously broken, that's going to be an issue.
Well, this is our Lawn and Garden edition of Focus on WYLL, and we are welcoming your questions on lawn and garden care. Sandra Mason of the U of I Extension is with us today, and our number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WYLL. Besides phone or email, you can also email us, you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. Seed catalogs come out about now?
Oh, yeah. Gosh, I've been getting them since December. For a lot of us, that's how we get through the winters, looking through all the catalogs. It makes us feel better.
Now, I don't know, are there trends? Are there anything new that comes out from year to year?
I think so. I think one of the trends we're probably seeing for the most part is, people don't have huge gardens like maybe they would have had in the past. So I think more and more, especially in the way of vegetables, we're seeing, compact varieties. There's some new green bean varieties that are actually good for containers. There's actually a sweet corn variety now that's good for containers. So it's not like you're going to get a huge crop by any means. You're not going to be, preserving, gallons and gallons of stuff. But if people are just wanting it just a little bit of fresh produce and that maybe they don't have a huge garden or they live in an apartment but they have some sun, you can do so a lot of the newer crops we're seeing more and more are really meant to be compact and in containers.
So for working with a small space,
right,
the seed companies are beginning to understand that not everybody's going to be going out and planting a long row of stuff.
Right, absolutely. And I think that's the great thing, I think, about gardening is the fact that it can be quite adaptable. You don't necessarily have to do this huge garden. You can do lots of things in containers. You can certainly mix flowers with vegetables. There's no reason why you can't do that within a container. I think one of the prettiest things I've seen is using actually just Swiss chard. There's a variety called Bright Lights that has all these colorful stems. And it's actually quite beautiful, but also edible. Swiss chard is quite edible. And then you can mix that with flowers within a container, and then suddenly you have something that you can enjoy the way it looks, as well as graze on it from time to time. So that's kind of nice.
This is all stuff that's best for this climate. Or?
Sure, absolutely. And so I think that's the other thing that's really kind of nice, in the fact that more and more people are realizing that you can mix those things, you can put them in, that vegetables don't have to be ugly. It's not that you have to put them in the back 40 because the vegetable garden or the vegetables are going to be ugly looking. There's lots of things now that are really quite pretty. I think a lot of the lettuces, there's a lot of leaf lettuces, probably one of the easiest things in the world to grow. Has very few insect and disease issues. You can plant it really early. By mid-March, you can plant leaf lettuce without any problem. So it's very, very adaptable. So I like leaf lettuce. And they're so pretty. There's, burgundy ones and speckled ones and just really a wonderful variety of leaf lettuce out there that can be planted very early.
Well, let's say hello to Shelley on line one from Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
I'd like to plant some apple trees, and the only place I really have that has good sun is in my front yard. And specifically, I'd like to plant a Honeycrisp and Gravenstein. Is this the type that I have to have three different types of apples, or just two different types, and can I grow these two together? And how far apart do they need to be spaced?
Yeah. Well, obviously, you're going to have to go with the dwarfs for that.
How
kind
come?
Of... Pardon?
How come?
Well, unless you have a huge front yard. Do you have a large front yard?
Oh.
Just to realize the semi-dwarfs are still going to be in that, 20, 25-foot category.
Okay, those be good then, semi-dwarfs, okay.
So, dwarfs are fine. It's just they don't have the extensive root system, so sometimes we have a problem with them leaning a little bit. But other than that, they do fine. You get quite a crop off of even a dwarf. So I have to think about the size. That would be the one thing. I'm not sure on Honeycrisp and Gravenstein. You'd really have to look and see. I don't know if they'll pollinate each other. Because with apples, you have to have another variety to pollinate it. And they have to be flowering at the same time.
Okay.
So I'd have to look, because I'm not sure exactly when those two, if those would pollinate each other. But wherever you get your apple trees, they'll tell you which ones it'll pollinate this, and this.
Okay. And when do I plant those?
You could certainly go ahead and order them. Normally, they'll arrive, bare root, and then as soon as you can get in the ground, you can plant them.
Okay, great. And one other question is, what seed catalogs do you like that I should order?
Oh, wow, that's tough. It really kind of depends on the things that you're looking for. I think... there is actually a website called Cindy's Catalog of Catalogs, and actually it's kind of nice because she actually has it set up so that you can look at, fruit trees or whatever, and then look at all the different ones that are there, the different catalogs, online sources that you can go to. So that one's actually kind of a nice website.
Catalogs of catalogs?
Yeah. Okay. I know, it sounds funny, but it's under different categories, and then you can go and see which ones are there. I think for all of them, what I would look for is anything that's nearby. So, Indiana has a couple of nice ones. If you're going for, like berries and trees and stuff, Indiana Berry Company is actually not too bad. So I would look nearby, something that's like Iowa, Indiana, Missouri, Wisconsin, or Illinois, kind of in that area, and those would be the ones I'd really sort of look for, especially if you're going for fruit trees and some of those kind of crops, certainly. But there's a lot of just the general ones are really quite good. I mean, Burpees and Parks is good. I love Seed Savers Exchange catalog because that's all heirlooms. They have flowers and vegetables both. So that's Seed Savers Exchange really is a great one too. Johnny Selected Seed, I like that one too for vegetables. Gosh, there's so many of them out there.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you very much. And let's go over to line four. I believe this is Dixie in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hello. I'd like to ask Sandy what's going to happen to my candy tuft, Iberis. The deer have come, scraped the snow off it, and eaten it off to the ground.
Oh, they've come already.
Yeah. I guess they're getting pretty hungry. We have 20 some of them hanging around the subdivision. Anyway, can Iberis have enough energy to come back up again, or is it just doomed?
Wow. If they actually cleared it off to the ground,
mm-hmm.
as in there's nothing left, I would think it's a shopping opportunity for you because don't know how well that's going to come back just from the roots. If there was still a little bit of crown, it'd be fine.
Okay.
I don't think you'd have any problem whatsoever. So I would just kind of wait and see. But, man, if they mowed it down to nothing, then I don't know about that.
It's nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know about it. Yeah, I think that's
the first time they've done that.
Wow.
I guess they got everything else finished off and so started on it.
So started on that. Wow. Wow.
Well, not started on it. They finished it.
They finished it. Yes. Not only started, but finished.
We'll see what's next.
Yeah.
Okay,
and it's,
thank you.
So they dug through the snow to get to it, kind of?
Yes.
Or?
Yes.
Wow.
And several of the neighbors have mentioned that they've seen the deer out just pawing, like, you know, you see the reindeer, the movies of reindeer or some animal way up north digging stuff off and getting at it, and that's what happens here.
Yeah, and you know, and that's the trouble when we talk about, like, deer-resistant or rabbit-resistant plants. You know, we're talking about things, you know, if they don't have anything else to eat,
yes,
you know, they're going to, you know, they're going to eat even things that they don't necessarily like all that much rather than starve. So, yeah, wow, good luck.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Dixie. Wow, deer! I imagine the winter has been tough.
When we get a regular snow cover like this, it's really hard for them because they can't even. There's not even any, you know, like leftover corn in the that they could find even in a field or whatever. It's really tough for them to actually find things to eat.
Well, are there side effects with other animals as well, which are coming around looking for things to eat and might start on, say, the bark of a tree or...
Yeah, rabbits are the other one. Because when we, again, they're another one of those, when we have a lot of snow cover, there's really hardly anything, there's nothing for them to eat other than twigs. And the interesting thing is, and I guess not interesting, but the sad part is that because of the snow cover, you know, and they'll actually stand on top of snow drifts. And I've gotten damage in my apple trees that you'd swear, you know, it had to be some giant rabbit or something because there's no way they would get that tall, but they will stand on the snowdrifts and they'll chew off the bark, they'll chew twigs, they really can do some major damage in orchards. If you have any new plantings, they love new shrubs, so this is actually would be a good time to just wander around your landscape a little bit and to see if they're starting to pick on certain plants, because if they are, you may want to actually use either a repellent, or you might actually, you know, what might be actually better is to use some wire, you know, caging or something like that, because once they start picking on a certain plant, they tend to keep picking on it. So,
yeah, just the fact that they found something.
They found something, and then they'll continue to come back to that same plant to the point where they can girdle, you know, they can kill trees and shrubs just by girdling the branches. And I mean, it's one of those things you can't blame them, you know, they're just trying to survive the winter time. But it's surprising sometimes that how much damage they can do.
And that's just one of the things they have to keep an eye on. Certainly, if you've have any examples of that yourself, we'd be interested in hearing some of your war stories. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Tell you what, we'll take a short break right now and be back with more lawn and garden questions and answers, and maybe talk a little bit about there's an event coming up in March.
Sure.
with Master Gardeners. And also, somebody's going to be getting some flowers today, so we'll talk about the best way to keep them around for a while. This is Focus on WYLL. This is Focus on WYLL. We are taking your lawn and garden questions with Sandy Mason, horticulture expert at the University of Illinois Extension. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. And, Sandy, there is an event. I see the flyer there that the Extension is having. Where is this going to be located?
Yeah, this is in Danville at the Crossroads Church on North Vermilion. This is the Vermilion County Master Gardeners. They've been doing this Garden Day Workshop and Spring Festival for, oh, my gosh, quite a few years now, 5, 6, 7 years, I'm not sure. But it's always a great event. And then, you know, being March 8th, it's sort of a way to sort of say goodbye, hopefully say goodbye to winter and welcome in spring. And the speakers this year are actually a nice variety of folks. Janet Makunovich, who's she's a professional gardener. She's an author. She has a couple of great books. She's actually from Michigan, but she has a business up there. And so I think the great thing about Janet Makunovich is just the fact that she is one of those folks that not only knows her stuff, but, you know, she lives and breathes it. So she really gives us a lot of great insight. She's going to talk about 8 months of continuous color. Doesn't that sound great for this time of year?
8 months we could
a
get that,
continuous
huh?
color. Absolutely. So she'll talk about different perennials and flowers that you can use to get that 8 months of color. We also have Susan Biggs Warner, who's with the Vermillion County Conservation District, and she's going to be talking and showing Cooking with Herbs. Her programs are always very, very popular. She does a great job. And then something a little bit different, we actually have Scott Elrick, who's with the Illinois Geological Survey. He's going to be talking about the geological secrets of Danville's fossilized forest, which is, it's just truly amazing.
Fossilized
forest, yes.
You mean like a petrified forest?
Yeah, yeah, it really
in
is.
Danville?
In
Danville?
Well, underneath Danville.
Okay.
And this is one of those things that people just really aren't familiar with. But once you start seeing the pictures, this is amazing. And these are just forests, really, that they found through the coal mining, that they found these fossilized forests. And it's just fascinating. I loved it. I've seen his program before, and he does a super, super job. So that's all March 8th. And there's also a great opportunity to shop. That's, you know, gardeners love to hear about gardening, but then we also like to shop. So there's some great vendors. There's lunch. It's really just a great opportunity for people to sort of get together and talk about gardening. And it's really inexpensive, you know, $20 pre-registered or $25 at the door, and lots of door prizes. So all people have to do is if they go to Extension's website, so extension.illinois.edu, and it's / C as in Champaign, F as in Ford, I as in Iroquois, V as in Vermilion. Or just go to the Garden Day Workshop and then look for that in Danville if you go on the Extension's website.
So that'll be coming up the 8th
yes, March
of
8th.
March.
Yep, absolutely. And it's at Crossroads Church just on North Vermilion, which is a great facility. And it really is a lot of fun. And to me, it's always like once we get to Garden Day, it's like, oh, we're finally, hopefully, in the spring. So
how many folks do you usually get out for an
you know,
event like this?
There's usually about 160, 175. So it's a pretty good crowd. They have, and the Master Gardeners make a great lunch. And it's just all the way around. It's a great day.
Well, today is Valentine's Day.
Yes.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Hey, happy Valentine's Day to you, too. This is great.
And we were thinking about cut flowers. Because there's a lot of cut flowers being passed back and forth today.
Yes, absolutely.
And just wondering about the best way to care for them. Maybe questions, where do these cut flowers come from? Because they, certainly not growing them out of doors here in Champaign-Urbana right now.
Right. You know, it used to be, years ago, like Payne, Illinois, and there was a lot of rose growers in Illinois. They were growing them under glass in greenhouses and stuff. But just with the, it's very difficult to heat a greenhouse in the wintertime. And so it's gotten to be harder and harder for people to actually produce them locally. So a lot of these are actually coming from either, South America or Europe or, they're coming from all over the place at this point. So it's one of those things that sometimes these flowers have certainly traveled more than we have sometimes. But that's a great thing, that we can get those and we can get them quite fresh. And that's one of the great things about them.
Are roses really the most popular flower on a day like this?
Well, certainly Valentine's Day. I think that traditional red rose, that long stem red rose, I think people really like. But I think more and more people have sort of expanded out into, I think lilies will probably be one of those that people really like simply because it's so fragrant. So those are really nice. And so I think a lot of times maybe a full bouquet is good. I think one of the things is that I would say is that don't wait for somebody to send flowers to you on Valentine's Day. Send them to yourself. Or go pick them up. I was just reading a little bit of a research study about how people feel better when they see fresh flowers. There's just something about seeing fresh flowers, especially in the morning. It actually translates all day long into your whole day. It makes you feel better. So I think it's worth it just to go ahead and send yourself some fresh flowers and don't wait for other people to do it for you. Just do it any time of year. I think probably one of the big things when people get the fresh flowers, if they're not already in a vase, probably the biggest thing is to get them in water right away. Don't leave them just as a bouquet. Go ahead and get them in water. It's always a good idea to recut the stems, when you get them.
Do you cut them straight or diagonally?
Diagonal is usually a pretty good idea to go ahead and just cut them diagonal. And then if you go ahead and then put them in fresh water and change the water every couple of days, that's always good too. So if the water starts to get cloudy or something in your fresh arrangement, then change it. Also, use that little flower. They always give you, good florists will send you that little packet of flower preservative with it, and use that.
That's actually
that's good stuff. That's actually really good stuff.
How much of a difference will that make?
It certainly by days, if not a week or so, it'll make on how long the flowers will stay fresh for you. Because sometimes I hear that people say, well, they just don't stay fresh long enough. Well, it could be kind of how you're taking care of them. So really use the packet. A lot of times you don't need the whole packet. Read the directions. A lot of times just half a packet, add it to the water, and then that gives you another, you know, half a packet to go ahead and redo the water again. You can actually make your own homemade flower preservative if you want to. And it's just add a white vinegar, sugar, bleach. You're really just trying to have a little sugar in there as well as a little acidic as well as a little bleach to keep down any bacteria and stuff. That's probably one of the big things too. And also remove any foliage that's underneath the water. You don't want any foliage in the water because it's just going to rot.
Okay.
So you never want to have any foliage in the water.
Does putting a penny in the water really help flowers live longer?
I know, it looks pretty, but no. It doesn't really help.
I had
all
not
that
heard
much.
Of this. Is this
I've
a thing?
Heard that before. Yeah, I've heard that before, but it really doesn't help. Actually, these homemade ones that I just mentioned, using either vinegar, you can actually also use non-diet, like Sprite, 7-Up, any of those limey lemonade ones, but they have to be non-diet. They need to have the sugar in them. And you can actually make your own floral preservative from that if that's what you have. But usually people have a little bleach and vinegar and sugar on hand that you can make your own preservative. So I think that's another thing. So you're much better off making your own homemade preservative and rather put pennies in your in the water.
Now, as the year goes on, you may be growing your own flowers,
right,
and you decide to bring some of them indoors as cut
right
flowers.
Right.
Is it different when you're dealing with flowers you've just cut compared to flowers grown commercially that you buy from a florist or even from a drugstore or whoever?
Yeah, I think probably the big thing is because, you know, you're just fresh cutting them, I think the big thing is just to really think about when you're cutting them. You'd want to do it early in the morning before they're really, you know, gotten hot all day long, while the flowers are so fresh in the morning. I think that's one of the things. So don't try to do it, you know, necessarily in midday when it's really hot. You'll see a lot more wilting on them. Some of the flowers do better as cut flowers. I think one of the great things, if you have the space, just to have a little spot where you can do like zinnias, like the old-fashioned zinnias or something, because those last forever in an arrangement. So some of them, if you're just really wanting a few flowers to bring in, those are good. Snapdragons are always really good. So when you go ahead and cut them, I think makes a big difference if you're going to do it from your own yard.
Okay, this will make a difference. They'll really last longer because of
they'll last longer and they won't wilt as much, because people may notice that they'll, even when you fresh cut them, sometimes they'll go ahead and wilt a little bit. So you want to get them in water right away. And actually, probably one of the best things to do is just to have a, you know, a pitcher or something as soon as you cut them, then put them immediately into water. Mm-hmm. As you cut them.
The commercial flowers, how long are they going to last realistically?
Yeah, it probably it depends a lot on the flowers. Things like carnations will last like weeks, I think. Roses you'll certainly get maybe a couple weeks. A lot of it depends on, you know, you pretty much in, I would say probably in the cut flower world, is that you pretty much get what you pay for.
Mm-hmm.
Usually the cheaper ones tend to not last as long because they've been graded out, and generally the reason they're able to offer those in a cheaper rate is often because they're not as good a quality as, or maybe they're a little farther along. So if things are in, you know, roses are in bud, certainly a couple of weeks you could get out of them without any problem. A lot of times if you have a full arrangement, you can take some of the ones that aren't doing as well and make a smaller arrangement out of the ones that are still doing well. Alstroemeria is one that lasts a long time. You easily get a couple of weeks out of those. Carnations last, as I said, last forever. Lilies, if you get lilies, usually it's in a bunch. So you'll have some that are still in bud, and you'll get easily a couple of weeks out of those. So it's really, and it's well worth it if you think about it, just the enjoyment that you get out of them every day.
The budding process can still continue even when they're separated from the roots?
Right, absolutely. So with some, that will work. So things like lilies are a really good example of that, where typically you'd probably have a couple of them that are in full flower and open, whereas there's also a few buds within the arrangement, and then those will continue to open.
Well, that certainly takes care of, gives us some opportunities for cut flowers,
mm-hmm,
which I hope some of you are getting today. And whether you're thinking of a cut flowers variety or the things you're going to be planting hopefully soon, give us a call with your questions. about lawn and garden care, give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. We're here with Sandy Mason of the University of Illinois Extension. You know, I'm wondering what sort of questions actually do come in to you just on a regular basis at this time of year.
Well, usually people are thinking about the future. They're thinking about the gardening season. And just what the question we had about moving the clematis is, you know, can I move this? Can I divide this? Those kind of things I think a lot of times people are thinking of because they've got plans for the season and they want to know what kinds of things that they can do. And I think that's the great thing about springtime is that there's so many things that we have that opportunity to sort of move around. And I think that's part of the great thing about gardening. Gardening is that one gardener told me one time that all her plants have wheels. She can move them. She just moves them around wherever she wants them.
We have a call now on line four out of Vermilion County. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. We took out an arborvitae windbreak from an area this past summer, and I'm wondering if that soil can be used for gardening this spring.
Oh, sure. Probably the biggest thing is I don't know how much, you know, arborvitaes don't have huge root systems, but you may be dealing with the root system. That'd be the only problem. But it's not going to be a problem with the soil at all, so
okay.
You'll be fine.
Great. Thank
yep.
you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you very much for that call. Our arborvitae, are there ever an issue with some plants? When you take them out, do they leave some sort of residue or condition of the soil?
Well, walnuts would probably be the one tree or plant that we would think of that actually gives off a toxin in the soil and can be a problem even once a tree is taken out. So that would probably be the one thing. I think a lot of times people think with some of the evergreens that they make the soil more acidic or whatever, and that's really not the issue for those. So it's usually just a root system issue if you're taking a plant out that was still alive and now you have to deal with the roots.
Let's go to line one. This is Mark in Lovington, Indiana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yes, my question is, where would a person go to source organic seed potatoes, both red and white?
Oh, wow. I don't know if you have some local garden centers you might check, but I would probably...
all over.
Oh, nobody has them? Oh, wow.
Nobody has much interest.
Okay. Well, I think you're probably going to have to look at a couple of the catalogs I'd mentioned before, like Johnny's Selected Seed has a lot of organic stuff. And I'm sure that
Johnny's Selected Seed.
Huh? And that's a big one. And Seed Savers Exchange would also have organics. And that's they're out of Iowa. And both of those are really good companies. I've ordered from them and had really good success with both of those. So.
I'm calling on my cell phone here, breaking up a little. What was the second one?
It's a Seed Savers Exchange.
Okay.
And I think it's just seedsavers.org and then Johnny's Selected Seed. So those would be two really good ones.
Thanks so much for your help.
Uh-huh, sure.
St. Patrick's Day is coming up. I can get going.
I know. I was just thinking about that. Yeah, that's when you got to plant the potatoes, St. Patrick's Day.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mark. People really plant potatoes for St. Patrick's Day?
Yes, that's a tradition. And actually, potatoes need to be planted early. This is the Irish potato, white potato we typically would think of. And it is one of those that needs to be planted early. And we generally would do that mid-March. And just to sort of, and I think that's really just one of those things to sort of think about is in St. Patrick's Day, oh, I've got to plant my potatoes.
Now, he was talking about seed potatoes, other ways of planting potatoes.
Well, traditionally we would call them seed potatoes. Their seed potatoes are just smaller potatoes, but it's the potato. It's just they call them seed potatoes because they're small. They're really not a seed. Yeah, it's a little confusing, I think. But it's just that they're generally smaller potatoes, and you plant the whole potato.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings up, I guess, the questions in general, the things you plant first.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like potatoes is one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a bunch of things. And the nice thing is we're actually not too terribly far from there. Like mid-March is actually a time we can start thinking about, certainly in central Illinois, we can start thinking about a lot of the really hardy stuff. So a lot of the leafies, so things like I was mentioning lettuce before, but even kale and spinach and a lot of those leafy plants that we think of tolerate frost very well, and they tolerate cold weather very well. So those would be some of the earlier ones, and certainly white potatoes would be in that category, radishes, even asparagus plants and rhubarb plants if you're thinking about some perennial-type crops. Any of the green onion seeds, onion sets, peas, So there's a lot of things. Once we get into mid-March, there's all kinds of things we can sort of get working
And even
on.
If the weather's sort of cool, I guess if it's above freezing.
They tolerate, yeah. Actually, they tolerate it just fine. And that's the good thing about these very hardy vegetables is that they're okay with really cold temperatures. And I think that's one of the nice things. We don't realize sometimes that there are these plants that, amazingly enough, can really tolerate cold temperatures. I've had even broccoli plants. Now, broccoli we usually do a little bit later into you know, late March into April. But I've had them, like, freeze solid, and I thought they were dead. I mean, I thought for sure they would be dead. But they had a little damage on the outside edge, but they were fine. So some plants that just have the ability within their cells not to freeze and fall apart. So we like that.
Well, this is Focus on WILL. We're talking with Sandy Mason of the U of I Extension about lawn and garden questions. Still time for yours. The phone number 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL, and the email address will-talk, that's will-talk@illinois.edu, where we have this question: do raised vegetable gardens take a lot more water than non-raised beds? Last year we tried growing both tomatoes and zucchinis. Neither did well. The zucchinis would get about 2 inches long and then rot on the vine. I think there might have been a pollination problem. The tomatoes were not plentiful. They were very small, except for the cherry tomatoes. They did well. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I don't know if it was necessarily a raised bed, and I don't know how big the raised bed is. You know, when they talk about that, is in, you know, usually like a, we typically think of raised beds, they'd be like 4 feet by 8 feet, something like that. So I assume they're talking about something that has some size to it, and it's not like a small container, because that might be an issue. Do they take a lot more water? They're going to take a little bit more water. I have raised beds, and I probably have to water them, you know, maybe a day or so earlier than I might in my beds that are in the ground. Other than that, I haven't really noticed a whole lot. So I think I would think of a couple things. What kind of soil they put in the raised beds? That's what I would think of. Was there plenty of organic matter? Was there compost mixed in with it? Because compost is going to be the thing that's going to really help to hang on to moisture. So I would really rethink what kind of soil they had in the raised beds. That would be number one. The other thing I would say is that sometimes zucchinis can have a big problem with some insect and disease issues. So I really wonder if that wasn't an issue for them. Because if you're actually getting the zucchini forming, then, you know, the fruit itself forming, then it's been pollinated, it's forming. So, but then if it's starting to rot, then I would wonder about some disease issues. So zucchini is sometimes a little hard. I'm not sure about the tomatoes. You know, I would ask sort of when, again, soil issues, when they planted them, what varieties they might have had. Because for the most part, you know, if you get them in a halfway decent time, they get established, you should be able to at least get some sort of a crop off of them. Again, unless you're having some insect and disease issues.
So watering the raised beds is not an issue?
I wouldn't say, and their comment was, does it take a lot more? And I would say no, it doesn't take a lot more. I probably have to water them a little bit earlier, as in instead of going, you know, 7 days, I might do it at the fifth day or something like that. So sometimes you have to water a little bit earlier, but as in more water, not necessarily.
When we're talking about raised beds, for filling in my ignorance here, are we talking about a soil that's really higher than the rest of the soil would
right.
be held in by some sort of frame?
Yeah, typically it probably is by some kind of frame. Often people use wooden sides on them, but you don't raise bed could actually just be raised a few inches. So that's why it's a little bit confusing sometimes when we talk about raised beds. But usually what people would do would actually build a bed using wood or, you know, cinder blocks or whatever it is, where you're actually raising it anywhere from, you know, 6 to 8 to maybe even 12 or 24 inches above the soil line.
And is this usually done to get in a different type of soil than is in the yard?
Absolutely. And so it's a couple of reasons why we might go with raised beds. If you have really lousy soil, it's a great way to, you know, add that soil and really get the good soil that you like, especially in areas that are maybe poorly drained soil. We have a lot of clay and it tends to not drain well. If you have raised beds, plants tend to do better. Also, it just brings the garden up a little bit higher so you don't have to bend over as far. So sometimes it's just easier for us. Good drainage, generally because you're not, you know, you're not having to have rows or anything like that. You can really do a lot of planting and put things really pretty close together because you're not having to have extra space for rows or whatever, because you can get to the bed from all the way around. So there's some real advantages to doing raised beds, and I like having them.
Okay. It makes me think of another thing that people might be thinking of early, and that's fertilizing, whether it's the garden or the lawn. Is that something that you'll be doing, not now, I guess, but once the snow clears, what's a good time?
Yeah, again, it sort of depends on what you're fertilizing. Typically, what we think of when it comes to fertilizing a lawn, for instance, we actually recommend that you wait a little bit later. Sometimes people get really excited and they want to fertilize their lawn really early, but generally, we recommend that to actually wait until the 1st of May or so, which I know for a lot of folks seems like really late, but we also recommend a late fertilization in the fall, like do something in November, and then that helps to green it up early in the spring, and then actually do your lawn fertilization the 1st of May. Mm-hmm. With other plantings, it again sort of depends on, I think with fertilization, you have to really think about, you know, whether, you know, why are you fertilizing? I think there should always be a reason why you're doing it, and don't just do it because you think that's what you're supposed to do, but have a good reason. So it could be things like, you know, maybe you have blueberries or something that need an acidifier to actually make it more acidic so the plants will grow better. So sometimes we actually do some fertilization so that we can make sure that our plants have the correct pH or some of those things. So a lot of it's just knowing, like, when.
It's not just an automatic thing.
Maybe at least automatic... in my man. Okay. Yeah. 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 Don't just have it. It's sort of like what I always say, like tilling. People always think they have to till everything and you really don't have to. Have a good reason on why you're tilling, why you're fertilizing. And you may find you don't really have to do those things. Actually, compost. I'm a big believer in compost. Just add compost. That adds some nutrients, but also helps with the soil structure. Also, you know, provides those wonderful, you know, bacteria and fungi and all those wonderful things that our plants like to have that live in wonderful relationship with those, and so we like feeding our soil. And so the big idea anymore is, at least in my mind, is to feed the soil that feed your plants. So, you know, really have good healthy soil, and compost really helps with that.
Do you have any particular plans for your garden in 2014?
Yeah, right.
Different from last garden. Year?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things. I planted so many peppers last year.
How did the peppers come out?
Actually, the peppers did really well.
What do you do with all those peppers?
I know, good question. I froze some of them, but then I was thinking, why did I plant all these peppers?
Are we talking
peppers?
About hot peppers, or are we talking...
Both. I had hot peppers as well as bell peppers. And I had, I had to have all these different colors, like reds and purples and yellows and oranges and all these kind of things. So I'm thinking maybe I need to tone that down a little bit. And I did freeze them, but peppers are one of those things. I like to have them fresh. And we did eat a lot of peppers, but I found out that I might have gone over a little bit overboard on that. So I think I'm going to really go back to that. I haven't grown sweet potatoes in a couple of years, and I miss having my fresh sweet potatoes. So I think it's some of the sort of toning down some of the things and getting back to some of the other things. But
you know, I'm wondering, after a winter like the one we're still going through now, if this is going to be sort of the norm for a few years anyway, because we go through periods of severe winters and mild winters. If you thought another one was coming, is there anything that you would do in your garden beforehand?
Yeah, I think I would really probably, I wish I had these things, and I think we've talked about it a little bit before on other shows, about this whole idea of low tunnels and high tunnels. These we've talked about, you know, where you actually put this plastic structure over your raised beds or your garden area so that you can have either leafy vegetables or whatever in almost, you know, 10 months out of the year kind of thing. And so I really, really, this is really pushing me more and more to think that I need one in my own backyard kind of thing.
Although, if whether or not we could have one in January and February, when you have a January and February like
right.
this one.
Right. But it would be a great way to get a early start on the garden, too. You know, you'd be able to actually plant things. Even if you didn't have things over the wintertime, you could actually start things earlier and that kind of thing.
So what do you think the chances are of something like this happening again next year?
I don't know. You know, we used to say, you know, then, you know, what's normal? And I don't know what normal is anymore. You know, when we talk about, you know, how, you know, I used to talk about, you know, spring and fall where we get most of our moisture and it tends to be cooler and hot and dry in the summer. I just don't even know if there is a normal anymore. So I think that's the one thing with gardeners is that you got to be adaptable. You have to be adaptable. Otherwise, you'll get very, very frustrated.
And that is the thing, not only did we not really know that this winter was coming. We don't know what sort of spring or summer we're going to get.
Yeah, and you know, I've heard all kinds of things about how summer's going to be hot and dry, and I'm just not looking forward to that. So I think people need to, you know, do some spring things, maybe adding compost that would help to hold moisture, maybe think about making sure you have rain barrels, you know, really thinking about how you're managing your garden.
Well, Sandy Mason, thank you very much
for
talking with
you.
Me today. Before you go, let's make one more mention of that workshop coming up on the 8th, Saturday the 8th of March at the Crossroads Church in Danville.
Yes, the Vermilion County Master Gardeners do a great job. Garden Day and Spring Festival, a great opportunity to get hear some speakers as well as shop. So it's Saturday, March 8th. It runs from 8 to 4 at the Crossroads Church in, on North Vermilion in Danville. All you have to do is go to extension.illinois.edu and search for Garden Day, and it should pop up for the Champaign, Ford, Iroquois, and Vermilion counties.
Well, let's hope some things are starting to melt
by
next
March
week.
8th.
At least by March 8th. That gives us another 3 weeks so.
It'll look much different, I'm thinking.
Well, Sandy Mason, thank you very much for being on Focus today. And hopefully things will be a little greener the next time you're on.
Let's hope.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. We are likely the first result on your search engine under WILL Focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. Ryan Weber is our intern for Focus. Monday is President's Day. On Monday's Focus, we are scheduled to talk with Harlow Giles Unger. He is the author of Mr. President, a new book on our first president, George Washington. We'll talk about how George Washington, as the first president, set precedents for many of the things presidents do. I shouldn't have chosen those two words together, that aren't necessarily authorized by the Constitution, but they're doing them anyway. That's on Monday's show. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. You can hear Focus on AM 580 over the air, and online at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen to past programs and sign up for our free downloadable podcast. That's at will.illinois.edu/focus. This is Focus on WILL.